Welcome to the OCR A-Level Psychology Podcast. Find out more at www.ocr.org.uk.
I said yesterday the last time I talked about this particular study in public was actually 1989. The data that was eventually published in 1994 was collected in 1988, so I'm essentially talking about things that are ancient history to me. I know we're here to talk about psychology, but I'm absolutely delighted that my work has found its way onto the A-level syllabus. I know that Alex and Steve are very pleased about their work being included on the A-level syllabus as well. I mean, I've been very lucky in my career to win lots of awards and honours, and I have to say this is up there for me, really feeling that my work is getting the kind of dissemination down right at the start of people's psychological career. So I'm absolutely delighted about that. So I'd just like to thank OCR and everybody who was involved in getting our work onto this particular syllabus. Okay, what I'm going to do before I start, I'm going to try and put my work into context, because since I've done this study that's on the syllabus, I've probably done another 19 years' work since then. And even though the field has moved on in lots of different ways, I think it's important to let you know that what I'm going to be talking today about is a very small piece of a very, very large jigsaw. Okay, and hopefully as I go along, I will introduce little bits of psychology. And I mean, it's very interesting. It's probably, for most of you here, it's probably the first time you've ever heard a talk in a casino. I looked on my CV last night. This is actually the 17th time I've given a paper in a casino. 15 of those have been abroad, normally in Las Vegas or Atlantic City, and this is only the second time in the UK I've spoken in a casino. Okay, well, the study I'm going to talk about was actually part of my PhD way, way back when I was studying at the University of Exeter back in 1987. And I did a whole range of studies during my PhD studies, and obviously this is just one, the study I'm going to concentrate on is just one part of a whole range of different things I did. And I had a very deliberate thing I wanted to do, which was to use lots of different methods to look into the area, particularly of adolescent gambling. And I was one of those people, I didn't actually, if you like, choose the PhD I was going to do. I got offered three particular PhD places, and I took the one at Exeter, mainly because I thought that would be the one that would motivate and maintain my interest for a three-year period. And as it's turned out, it's probably the luckiest break I've ever had in my life doing this particular PhD. The first thing I did, because the great thing about the area that I came into, there was literally nothing on it, certainly nothing in terms of fruit machine gambling, which is the main focus of my PhD. I did a PhD on fruit machine addiction. And the first thing I did was actually do a small observational study and do some interviews with just eight fruit machine gamblers in Loughborough. I mean, that was my hometown. I had access to a particular arcade there, and I knew some of the locals there. And that's how I started off. I then did a much bigger study interviewing 50 fruit machine gamblers in Exeter. And then I had published a few case studies as well. I've got some really, I mean, can I just say, my email address is on there. I'm somebody that loves giving resources out. If people want my work, email me, and you'll probably get too much. But I love people to obviously be interested in the stuff that I did. One of the things I also did during my PhD, I spent 2 years monitoring 33 different amusement arcades up and down the country, as far as north as in Yorkshire, also in the Midlands, and quite a lot down in the southwest, in Torbay, in Dawlish Warren, in Tynmouth, in Exeter. And that, for me, was actually one of the most exciting things to do, was to take part, actually be a participant actually during the research process, and be a non-participant as well. But I also rounded off my PhD by doing a couple of experimental studies, and I say that the one I'm going to talk to you about today is probably the most infamous one, or most famous one I've done, where I basically looked at gamblers' thought processes while they were actually playing a machine. I'll talk more about how I did that and what I found a bit later on. I also did a very interesting experiment where I actually measured people's heart rates while they were playing gambling. And one of the things I've always argued is that, particularly when we talk about things like addiction, is that fruit machine playing, gambling in general, can be a very exciting activity, and obviously on a psychobiological level and a psychological level, it can be a very, very reinforcing behaviour. And what I found in my study is that when people were playing slot machines, is that they became very, very aroused. And quite interestingly, they not only became aroused when they won, they also became aroused when they nearly won. Okay, and the reason I point this out is that from a manufacturer's perspective, this is very, very interesting, because basically you can design fruit machines to give lots and lots of what we call near-winning experiences. Okay. Now, the thing is, when the media ring me up and go, Mark, we've got all these gamblers, we've got a small, very small proportion of problem gamblers, why do they keep on gambling if they're always losing. And you've got to remember that gamblers don't constantly lose. Gamblers constantly nearly win. And the nearly win is actually very, very psychologically and physiologically reinforcing too. Now, the kind of model, and this is it's been quite obvious, within sort of 5 or 6 years of working in this area, it became clear to me that there are lots of different factors that kind of impinge on how and why people gamble and how and why people develop problems with gambling. And myself and Jonathan Park, we've written a lot about what we call the global model of gambling behaviour. And we basically, in a very simplistic way, think that all types of gambling, and in fact lots of addictive behaviours you could say about this, falls down to three basic sets of characteristics. We've got the individual characteristics, the situational characteristics, and structural characteristics. And basically what that means is the individual characteristics are all those things that are, if you like, inherent within the individual. It's their biological and genetic predispositions. It was the social environment they were brought up in. It was their, if you like, the psychological component, personality factors, expectations, beliefs, thought processes. Okay, so everything that's inherent within the individual would be the individual factors. And obviously, the gambler is responsible for their own gambling behaviour. However, and I would actually argue that 99% of research in gambling has been done in that little purple box, is looking at individual factors of how and why people gamble. I've actually spent most of my career looking at what we call situational and structural factors. Okay, how was this casino designed? That would be an example of a situational factor. How does this casino pull you in the first place? What does it do in its environment as a way of getting you to gamble? Situation, and this is what I would call micro situational characteristics, but there are also macro ones as well, things like advertising getting you to gamble in the first place. How many locations have you got in a particular area? Okay, now, what's very interesting in terms of gambling at the moment is that gambling has become very technologized. Okay, and the situational determinants of gambling have changed completely over the last 5 years, because now, instead of making a decision that you want to travel somewhere to go and gamble in a casino like this, is that literally from a push of a button, you can gamble through the internet, gamble through your mobile phone, gamble through interactive television. You have got convenience gambling, basically, from as long as you've got the technology, you can do it in any way you want now. The great thing about me now, of course, I can play poker naked if I want to now in my house. I don't have to worry about membership, I don't have to worry about fees to get in, I don't have to worry about travelling, I don't have to worry about the dress code. The whole point about gambling now is that basically gambling has become technologised and the situational determinants of gambling have changed. From we know that about just under 1% of British adults have a problem with their gambling. Okay, and for those small minority, it's from one of the things I've been trying to argue, it's the structural characteristics of the activity itself contribute to problem gambling. And one of the things I'm going to be trying to argue today is that there are lots of different things that manufacturers and designers put into their products as a way, not when they've started you gambling, is to get you to gamble again and again and again and again. Okay. Now, the good news, of course, is that most people do not have a gambling problem. But obviously, if you've got those predisposing individual risk factors, the industry are responsible for the structural and situational factors. And I say, most of the research I've been doing, particularly over the last 15 years, has been looking at what are these factors that are actually involved. Now, I haven't got, obviously, I can only spend about a minute on each of the next three slides. But just to give you an idea, just on an individual level, there's clearly lots of psychological factors that play a part in a person's individual psychology. And I'm probably quite rare as a psychologist. I'm a true eclectic. Okay, no one can turn around to me and say, Mark, you're a cognitive psychologist or a social psychologist or a developmental psychologist. Basically, I'm just a psychologist. In fact, most of my most recent writings have been in sociology, criminology, social policy. In fact, I would almost describe myself now as a social scientist rather than as a psychologist. But it's quite clear that when it comes to the psychology of gambling, there are clearly unconscious motivations to gamble. If you ask people why they gamble, particularly problem gamblers, they actually can't actually verbalize why they do something sometimes. And even though I'm no Freudian, I'm not particularly into psychodynamic theories, it's quite clear that there are certainly unconscious motivations for some people. There are the cognitive aspects, the thought processes, the expectations, the beliefs. And okay, that's what I'm going to really concentrate on today. There are various personality factors in there. There are obviously predisposing genetic and biological factors in there. There are also quite clearly behavioural factors in there. I mean, classical conditioning and operant conditioning are absolutely critical to how and why people gamble. I mean, Skinner, in his book in 1953, used the fruit machine as it was almost like behavioural psychology 101, using the fruit machine as the ideal way to explain what operant conditioning was all about. So there are clearly lots of psychological factors. There are also lots of situational factors. And again, I haven't got, I mean, basically when I do my lectures at Nottingham Trent University, I usually spend an hour or two going through each of these. The ones I'll just pick out, just out of interest, top left-hand corner, they're sensory factors. Okay, when you are designing a casino, for instance, there are lots of things you can do to manipulate people's behavior if you want to. So you can use everything from smell, sight, colors, light, etc., to try and influence the environment. So, for instance, there have been psychological experiments showing that people, when they gamble under red light, actually spend far more money than they do under blue light. When you go into lots of gambling environments, what you tend to find is that things are towards the red end of the spectrum. They're in the yellows, the oranges, the reds. Red's a very exciting, arousing colour, and people do actually gamble more, gamble faster under those types of environment. In Las Vegas, they will actually, some casinos will spray their slot machines with particular aromas. Okay, and you can actually increase takings on a machine by using particular smells. Okay, sound is very important as well. Okay, when you're playing on a slot machine and you hear the ka-chunk, 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 ka-chunk of a machine playing paying out, you've got metal coins falling into a metal payout tray, emphasizing that win. Okay, this is what we psychologists call the availability bias. Okay, it's basically emphasizing something that probably is quite a rare event compared to losing. Another example of using the availability bias is, for instance, I don't know if you remember when the National Lottery was first introduced. They used to have a National Lottery program where every week they actually brought on the winners. You know, they'd say, here's Mr. Jones. Last week he won $3.3 million on the National Lottery. Here's Mrs. Evans. Last week she won, $1.2 million on the National Lottery. What they never did was, here are the 29.9 million people who didn't win at all. The whole point about that is emphasizing winning as if it occurs more often than it actually does. There are various other things. I mean, one of my kind of, if you like, favorite... I'll just go on to the next slide because this is probably more important in terms of developing problems. I've spent most of my career looking at what we call the structural characteristics. Okay, the single most important structural characteristic which will probably determine whether people develop a problem or not is in the top left-hand corner there, what we call event frequency. Okay, it's almost impossible for a person to become addicted to a bi-weekly National Lottery. The reason is that addictions are really all about constant reinforcement, about constant reward. You cannot become addicted to something unless you're getting those constant reinforcements. A bi-weekly National Lottery, you only get two chances a week to be rewarded for your gamble, i.e. finding out the result of the numbers that you've put on. Now, obviously, that doesn't mean that you can't spend too much. I know lots of people who buy probably far too many tickets, but you only get the result of that particular gamble twice a week. So, in fact, the reward schedule is very, very low, very low event frequency. Now, obviously, something like a slot machine or some of these virtual roulette machines here, these have very high event frequencies. On a slot machine, you can gamble 12 times a minute. On some internet slot machines, you can gamble 30 times a minute. Okay, really, it's only dictated by the speed of the particular reels. Okay, I remember a big debate in the Dutch Parliament where they debated for 12 hours whether the speed of their reels should be 3.5 or 3.6 seconds. Okay, now the reason they did that is that point tenth of a second is that if you've got somebody playing all day on slot machines, all those those tenth of a seconds add up. The more time people are playing on it was more at the time more guilders for the industry. I mean, the speed it basically can dictate things like profits. Now, of course, you might say to yourself, well, it's quite clear from what you're saying, Mark, that things like lotteries are not problematic. But, of course, in America, they've got a lottery game called Keno. Okay, Keno is basically a game where there's a lottery draw every 5 minutes. These games are typically played in supermarkets and post offices. So it's not the case that lotteries cannot be problematic. It depends on the structural characteristics of the activity. So where you've got basically a National Lottery draw every 5 minutes, I can tell you now, to vulnerable and susceptible individuals, they are problematic and potentially addictive. There are certainly other... I've already mentioned the near miss there, for instance. That near miss is very important in gambling. So people who design scratch cards, people who design fruit machines, try and maximise near-winning experiences. And in fact, we've written a lot of work about how near misses have evolved over the years, particularly in terms of slot machine playing. Traditionally, a near miss on a slot machine was put your money in, the reel spin round, first reel spins round lemon, second reel spins round lemon, third reel spins round lemon, just above or just below the pay line. That is a classic near win experience. However, most in this country, I have no idea how many of you play fruit machines here, but most regular players try and get what they want to do is get on what's called the feature board. They're not really bothered about the reel spinning. They want to actually play the game that's on the slot machine. And a lot of these things rely on what's called the number system. Okay, and what you have is fruit symbols that have numbers on, 1, 2, and 3 typically. And so, for instance, and I'll be talking about a machine that I used in my particular research called Fruit Skill. Okay, basically what happens on this particular game, the aim was to light up all the letters of the word Fruit Skill. So you had to light up 10 letters of a machine's name. And so what would happen is the reels would spin. You know, you might get a cherry with a 1 on it, a lemon with a 2 on it, an orange with a 3 on it. And if those three things, even though they're all different symbols, all came up, you would have 6 points. And that would light up F-R-U-I-T-S, of the fruits of the fruit skill. Now, the way these machines are designed, of course, what we typically found in our research is that quite often is that players were actually able to light up 9 of the 10 letters. They would actually forfeit wins in a way to try and maximise their jackpots, but in fact when they'd got the 9 letters lit up, is on the just waiting for that 10th one, the machine would just go back to the start again. This is another example of a near-miss experience. And it's very, as I said in my research, we found that it was both psychologically and probably more importantly, physiologically reinforcing, is that people were still getting this buzz, this high arousal from actually nearly winning as well. Another one that I would just point out, I didn't point out this yesterday, I thought I'd do something new for the people that heard this yesterday, something called suspension of judgment. Okay, when you come into the casino here, okay, one of the first things you do if you want to play any of the tables here is you'll swap your cash for chips. Now, obviously, from the casino's perspective, it's a very good security measure not to have cash on the table. But from a psychological perspective, what chips do is they turn money into virtual representation of money. And the important thing about that is that it lowers the psychological value of the money. Okay, so when you play with a chip, even though you know you've probably just lost £50 on a table, is the virtual representation of it psychologically isn't the same as if you just use cash. We know for a fact when you go into a store and they give you a store card and you're paying with plastic, even though you know how much you've just spent using your piece of plastic, okay, it doesn't feel psychologically the same as if you were paying out in cash. Now, this morning, I travelled down from Nottingham to London. It was £124 on the train. £124. And I paid with my credit card. I knew it was £124. I can tell you now, if I'd have paid that out in fivers, it would have seemed like a hell of a big fare compared to just giving over a piece of plastic. Now, the reason I mention suspension of judgment, obviously in terms of casinos and using chips, on slot machines, there are lots of tokens used. And probably in terms of what's happening today, of course, is when you play on the internet, you're playing with virtual cash. You're playing with e-cash. When you ring in the middle of the night playing ITV Play through the night, and you're trying to basically play these lotteries that go through the night, you're using your premium rate telephone line number. These are virtual representations of cash. People don't actually realize how much they're spending because they are virtual representations of it. And I say the great thing about them, it lowers the guilt over losing. Okay, and while I'm speaking about the guilt about losing, one of the reasons that slot machines tend to be far more problematic, of course, is it's got a very, very quick payout interval. Okay, so basically you put your money in, you find out within a few seconds whether you've won or lost, and if you have lost, you're straight on to the next gamble. You've got no time to think about the money you've just lost on the previous gamble. So the payout interval is very, very short. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is basically talk about this one particular study. And obviously, I'm going to try and put it into perspective of the kind of global model of gambling that I've been talking about. Now, back in 1988, there was a particular book that came out by a guy called Willem Wagenaar, and I've described Willem as a kind of academic terrorist. Basically, he works in lots of different areas. He comes in, he writes a few things in an area, quite controversial, kind of drops a bomb and then goes away and actually has no part in the kind of debate again. And I think that's very healthy for people to come on and just stir things up. And in his book, in 1988, he wrote a book called Paradoxes of Gambling Behavior. And there's two particular quotes I've lifted from here, which it kind of made me think about, if you like, gamblers and their thought process. I mean, traditionally, when I've been doing all my reading, people were looking at whether there was a particular gambling type of personality. You know, were there particular people who were predisposed? Willem Wagenaar came along and said that gamblers are motivated by a way of reasoning, not by defects of personality, education, or social environment. And he also said that gamblers gamble not because they have a bigger repertoire of heuristics. And heuristics are basically a rule of thumb. Okay, I'll talk about those in a minute. But because they select heuristics on the wrong occasions. So, for instance, we know there's literally, in that 1994 paper I published 16 different heuristics that are there. Okay, so you had things like what's called the representativeness bias. Does someone want to turn the music off, or do I have to speak over it? This is my big karaoke moment, isn't it? So heuristics are basically rules of thumb. So for instance, I don't know about you, but let's say you're playing roulette and seven reds in a row have come up. Okay, how would you bet if seven reds had come up? Some gamblers will say, well, red's obviously a lucky number. I'm going to put my money on red. Probably more often, people will say, well, because of the law of averages, black is going to come up next. This is what's called the classic gambler's fallacy. It is a heuristic that is well known, okay? And one of the things that Vagenaar was actually arguing, as I said, this is actually very, I feel like a person that's got an earpiece in, like on a... So basically, Vagenaar was arguing that people basically use these heuristics in the wrong way. Okay, I'm just going to talk about... I mean, I had lots of hypotheses in the particular study that I did. Okay, the first hypothesis I had was I did believe that gamblers had a different thought process than either non-gamblers or non-regular gamblers. Okay, so my first hypothesis... Great. There would be significant differences in between the thought processes between regular gamblers and non-regular gamblers. My second main hypothesis was basically... I mean, I basically believed that fruit machines were... basically chance determined, that was very little skill involved in them. And I actually had the null hypothesis here. I was basically saying I didn't think there'd be any behavioural differences in terms of, you know, how long fruit machine gamblers could stay on compared to non-regular gamblers. Doing well here. The method I used was, I suppose you'd describe it as a quasi-experimental method. And for me, the great joy I had in doing this is that I was allowed to actually use an arcade in Exeter to do my experiment. I had, for the first time, had what I would consider an ecologically valid experiment. Most experiments that had ever been done before had been done in a lab situation. And it was really lucky at the time in 1988, I'd organised the first ever conference on adolescent gambling down in Exeter. I got a lot of press publicity at the time, and in fact one of the local arcade owners said, I was really interested in your research, Mark. If you'd like to come and use my facilities, you can come in and do some experiments. And that is actually why I ended up doing some experiments, because, you know, an arcade owner came to me and said, you know, I'll give you free run of my arcade to do your work. I had two groups of participants, a group of regular and a group of non-regular gamblers. The independent variable in this case was either whether they were regular or non-regular players. I had 60 people who took part, or 60 gamblers who took part in my research. And when this went through the ethics committee, one of the stipulations was is that every participant in my experiment had to have played slot machines before. I was not allowed to use anybody who hadn't played slot machines before. And I think that's a fair thing to do. The last thing you want to do, particularly if you have the, you have the belief that a small proportion of people could end up being a problem gambler because of this, is no point getting someone to do something they've never actually done before. So I had a group of what I call 30 regular gamblers who played at least once a week on slot machines. In fact, a lot of them played a lot more than that, but that was my minimum criteria of playing at least once a week. My non-regular gamblers, they had to have played on average at least once a month or less. And in fact, a lot of them really only played maybe once a year, if that. It was a volunteer sample. Okay, I basically put posters up. I managed to put posters up in an arcade around the university. I also I got to know one of the fruit machine gamblers very well, who obviously knew lots of other fruit machine gamblers. And it was kind of word of mouth thing of people wanting to take part in my experiment as well. So this is, say, it's a volunteer sample. And I had a group of what I would call subjective dependent variables and objective dependent variables. Now, my subjective dependent variables, these were basically... the first one was looking at a gambler's cognitive activity. And the way I used this was what's called the thinking aloud method, which I'll come to in a minute. The second one is I was looking at perceptions of skill. How skillful did these gamblers think that they were when they played a slot machine? Okay, and basically I did this through a post-experimental questionnaire, and I had a whole list of questions about how skillful did they think they were compared with the average player, and I asked them to list what skills did they think were involved in playing a fruit machine. I haven't got time to talk about today, but in fact there were 21 different skills that were listed by fruit machine players. And my objective dependent variables, I had a whole range of these. I had I looked at the total number of plays that they did throughout the session. Okay, I also looked at the total minutes they managed to spend on the machine during the session. We had what was called the play rate, which was the total plays per minute.
We had the end stake, the total number of winnings, and that could be anything from a 10-pence win through to a much bigger one. We had the total number of wins in each session, the win rate in terms of both time and play. So how much time did they have between each win, how many plays between each win. And it was me basically standing by the person. I mean, I ought to just mention at this point, okay, one of the things we found out from some of the research one of my PhD students, Jonathan Park, has been doing. In fact, Jonathan just got his PhD 6 weeks ago. He found that social facilitation actually is a big factor in how people gamble. He's looked at lots of different variables, and it, depending on whether the person next to you is a friend or not, depends whether you're a regular or irregular gambler, is that how you gamble might be totally dictated by the particular people that are around you. So one of the real confounding variables in this particular piece of research is I was literally standing by these fruit machine players right the way through the experiment. And for some of the regular players, that actually now, because of some of the work that we've done in the last... particularly in the last 6 years, is that that may have been a confounding variable in actually inhibiting how some of these players might actually be playing. Now, the objective was to stay on the machine for at least 60 plays. Now, I was actually being funded by the Economic and Social Research Council, and they actually gave us, in my research grant, money that people could gamble with. We actually had a budget for people to gamble on the slot machines, and we gave all of our participants at the start £3 to play on the slot machine. And the objective for them was to try and break even. Okay, they had to put the £3 in and try and win the £3 back. That meant staying on the machine for 60 gambles. If they reached that 60, okay, they then, if they wanted, if they got any money at that point, they could walk away, keep the winnings, or they could play on. It was up to them. And in fact, there's been a lot of research showing that if you allow participants to keep the money or the financial reinforcement for taking part, that is a big motivating factor. The fact, you know, you might argue the fact we've given the people the money that they may not care with what they do with it, but in fact, because we've said that any winnings you have, you can take it away with you, that was actually a big motivating factor. Say, just as I said before, one of the controls that I had is that every single player played on the same machine. I have to say, is that a lot of the regular players didn't like the fact that I'd chosen the machine for them. A lot of regular players really do have favourite machines. Okay, I talk about one of my case studies, a guy that I called David. I followed for about 6 or 7 years. David had a particular machine that he played. When if you walked into the arcade with David and someone was on his machine, okay, it was as if somebody was being unfaithful with his machine. When I've written about a lot of what I call a concept of electronic friendship. Okay, it was quite obvious that people do develop relationships with machines, and certainly the work that I've done on video game addiction and excessive internet use is that people's relationships with technology can get very, very personal. Okay, and in fact, when we look at the cognitive activity, one of the things that comes out is how people personify the machine that they're actually playing. But David, the interesting thing was, on his 18th birthday, he got given a motorcycle by his mother and father for his 18th birthday. The next day, he sold it for a really lowly figure of £2,000, and within 24 hours, every single penny of that £2,000 had gone into one particular slot machine down in Torbay. Not in any particular, it's one particular. He had a very particular machine that he liked to play. And I say that could have been another confounding variable. I was getting regular gamblers to play a machine that wasn't their favourite machine. Okay, but in the interests of experimental control, I wanted everybody to play the same machine. These 60 participants I had, I randomly assigned them basically to what I called the thinking aloud condition or the non-thinking aloud condition. Okay, and the thinking aloud condition, basically what they had was a little lapel recorder. Okay, and while they were actually gambling, I told them to basically think aloud. So basically, I told them to say everything that went through their mind. Okay, secondly, not to censor any of their thoughts, to try and keep talking continuously, and then fourthly, to remember you don't have to speak in sentences, just say things as they're happening. Now, because of the way this happened, is that one thing, and I could only run basically one or two participants a day because I wanted to transcribe these within the 24-hour period because I could still remember the context of how this happened and what they were actually describing. Now, one of the downsides of this, and again, it's one of the flaws, is that when we did some inter-rater reliability afterwards, when I got another person, the first time we did it, we had a really low inter-rater reliability of about 0.3. Someone that didn't even play slot machines was trying to, in the way I'd coded things, for them to try and do it. And it became almost impossible because they actually didn't understand the fruit machine terminology. We then tried to do it again, even with a fruit machine player, and he just said, well, I didn't know, you know, when he was going through, he said, I don't know the context of how they were saying this. And in fact, even though the inter-rater reliability went up a bit, it was still actually very low. So that's one of the things you need to bear in mind in terms of replicability of this type of experiment. So what did I find? Okay, I'm just going to quickly gloss over this. This is actually in the pack in front of you, and it's in the paper in general. I've got all the, if you like, the individual behavioural findings of all of the four groups in terms of all these different variables. And there were actually, even though I wasn't expecting to find any differences, I did find some differences. Okay, when we did a few ANOVAs on this, what we found was that regular gamblers did actually stay on the machine slightly longer than non-regular gamblers. And in fact, again, since we've done this piece of work, one of my research students, Jonathan Park, who spent the best part of 4 years totally engrossed in slot machine playing and basically took a job as a cashier in an arcade to collect all his data, spent 15 months collecting all this kind of data. One thing he found, which I found very interesting, is that we did actually discover that British slot machines are totally different from slot machines anywhere else in the world. Slot machines elsewhere in the world do actually run using a random number generator. So it means that each individual gamble is totally independent of the gamble that happened before. However, what we've discovered, and we've actually tracked down the patent for this, is that slot machines in the UK, they use what's called adaptive logic. And in fact, the adaptive logic was basically, it was introduced so that small shopkeepers, particularly those who run chip shops, cafes, etc., is that they knew they would get a regular income from their slot machines over much shorter periods, because typically slot machines kind of even themselves out over maybe a year-long period, maybe over 100,000 gambles or even bigger. Basically, what we've got now is a situation in this country is if a slot machine player watches a machine fill up with somebody else's money it hasn't paid out, that slot machine player does know that that money is going to be paid out around about 72% or whatever the particular payback is. And so what you get is a lot of slot machine players that are called backstabbers, they're called skimmers, they're called sharks, who basically, these are regular players who just literally watch people playing and watch the machines filling up with money, and then basically as soon as the person has left, they jump onto that particular machine and basically take the winnings. Okay. And to be honest now, some of the things, I mean, I had no idea about this when I was doing my research, and in fact, some of the skills that people listed out of these 21 different skills, actually a lot of us related to knowing when the machine was going to pay out. Okay, and I just thought this was basically a myth. But in fact, because of the adaptive logic system, there are people out there that do genuinely make money from slot machines. The second thing I found was that regular gamblers had a significantly higher play rate. Basically, in the course of a minute, they were gambling basically at least 8 times a minute, whereas non-regular gamblers were only gambling 6 times a minute. The third thing is that non-regular gamblers who thought aloud had slightly more wins than any other group. Now, this is kind of a slightly misleading finding, because the interesting thing what regular gamblers did is that once they were given a 10p win, what they would then try and do is use this on the player board and actually try and magnify their win to get much higher prizes. But obviously, on the course of doing that, they may just lose the win completely. Typically, non-regular gamblers just took the lowest win possible. So, in fact, non-regular gamblers did actually end up with more wins, but that's because regular gamblers were actually trying to multiply their wins into much bigger ones. And we also found that regular gamblers who thought aloud had a significantly lower win rate than any other group. And again, I would explain this by the fact that in terms of win rates, it's, you know, the regular gamblers might, for instance, just have one or two wins, but it was quite a lot of money, whereas the non-regular gamblers were actually taking the really small wins. Far more interesting from my perspective, okay, was, if you like, these cognitive variables. I did a complete content analysis of the transcripts, and this was no small matter, I can tell you. This is probably, out of all the things I did in my PhD, this is probably the thing that took me the single longest time to do. I came up with 31 different categories of verbalization that people had while they were playing fruit machines. Four of those I classed as irrational types of verbalization. The other 27 I said were actually fairly rational types of verbalization. And obviously the hypothesis I had was actually confirmed, because regular gamblers did produce significantly more of these irrational verbalizations when compared to non-regular gamblers. And we also found out, when we looking at terms of heuristics that gamblers were using, is that regular gamblers used far more heuristics. Particularly, there's one called hindsight bias. Hindsight bias is when people say, "I knew that was going to happen." So you get people on a fruit machine, and something would happen, they go, "I knew it was going to do that." Okay, that would be a typical kind of hindsight. You know, they only say they knew it after the event. But that was really, really common amongst regular gamblers. Whoops. And what we found, here are some of the differences between the regular and non-regular gambling groups on some of these cognitive variables. That one of the most significant was what I call personification of the machine. I talked about this idea that people have relationships with a machine. It was quite obvious that we had people who would literally talk to the machine. They would laugh at the machine, stroke the machine. You know, they were actually treating it as if it was a real human being. Okay, lots and lots. And I'll give you some examples of that in a minute. Another thing that gamblers, regular gamblers, typically did, okay, what they would do is explain away their losses as something due to the environment, but when they won, it was because of their own personal skill. I mean, this is typical kind of what I'd call locus of control type of finding. I mentioned the number system before about that kind of lighting up the number of letters. Obviously, this was something I was totally unaware of when I did the research, what the number system was all about. It's not surprising that the regular gamblers mentioned this number system significantly more than the non-regular gamblers. Obviously, other references to skill. Again, regular players did this significantly more than non-regular gamblers. And obviously, the other way around, there was lots of statements and questions that basically the non-regular gamblers hadn't got a clue what was going on in front of them, just totally confused and baffled by what was going on. And this was highly significant when we compared these two groups. So I'll give you an example of some of the irrational verbalizations. And again, in the British Journal of Psychology paper this came from, there's a whole load of them there. So we have things like, this fruit is not in a good mood. I mean, this is a classical, you know, for me, the idea that a machine can actually have an emotional mood state. The idea, you know, people were talking along, right, I put all this money in, the machine wants its money back now, I put this in. This is a lovely one. This is actually one of our own psychology students. I remember this really well. Guy said to me, and I didn't put the next bit here, he said, putting only a quid in bluffs the machine. And he added, that's my own psychology. He actually said this while he was playing. Another one, this is actually the only, you probably know, I didn't point out actually, that in my regular gamblers, 29 of the 30 were males. Okay, now some of you might say, I mean, I did try to get equal genders amongst that, but in fact, as you probably know, fruit machine gambling is almost totally in this country the domain of male players, particularly in arcade subculture. I tried to get more females, and the one female I did get actually described herself as a tomboy, and the other people in the arcade saw it as an honorary male. But this quote actually came from her, and she said, the machine thinks I'm a fuckwit, and added, it's not wrong. Okay. And I am very, I suppose it is something on my CV that I'm probably the first person, I think, to get the word fuckwit into the British Journal of Psychology. But anyway, this machine won't pay out happily. Again, the idea of attributing human characteristics. You know, honestly, we've just got loads of these that particularly came from the regular gamblers. So the conclusions are that regular gamblers in this study did actually appear to be more skillful. It's not something I was expecting. And now, in the light of the recent research that myself and Jonathan Park have been doing, this has actually been explained, I think, through the fact that the machines do use adaptive logic rather than a random number generator. The second thing is that regular gamblers actually, even though the machines, there is some skill to playing, particularly we looked at the post-experimental questionnaires, is that regular gamblers thought they were significantly more skillful than they really were. I mean, in effect, what happened is that they took a few more goes, usually about 10 more goes, to spend the same amount of money in the same amount of time. Basically, they did be able to multiply their wins up to stay on the machine longer. And I think this is very interesting with the kind of third conclusion. One of the things I would argue is that the psychology of gambling is different from every single form of gambling. The psychology of playing the lottery is very, very different from the psychology of playing fruit machines, which is very different from the psychology of horse racing. And in fact, what we found in our research is that gamblers know they're going to lose every penny in the long run. Their whole objective is to stay on the machine as long as possible using the least amount of money. And in fact, because of some of the work I was doing on video game players at the time in the same arcades, this is exactly the philosophy they use. They went in, and they were, you know, playing, I don't know, Galaxian or whatever game was out at the time. They'd put their 20 pence in and see how long they can make that 20 pence last. Effectively, that's what fruit machine players were doing as well. Now, a good day for a fruit machine player is coming in with £10 and making that £10 last hours. A bad day for a fruit machine is they come in with £10 and it's gone in 10 minutes. Okay, so for them, it was all about staying, and they were playing with money rather than for it. Okay, I mean, basically, the money was a means to enter, stay in the action phase of gambling. And we also found, say, the main conclusion from this particular study was that regular gamblers did produce significantly more irrational verbalizations and demonstrated this cognitive bias. Okay, a couple of things I just say before I end, okay? I just want to obviously talk about some of the applications and some, if you like, evaluating the study in terms of some of the limitations. Well, the applications, one of the things I've argued is that if we know that gamblers are making these common mistakes in terms of how they're thinking about gambling, that maybe we can use that in a therapeutic sense, use it in terms of cognitive behaviour therapy, can actually be used to help problem gamblers to change their behaviour. And I've got a true story. About 6 months after I did this particular experiment, I was in a pub called the Double Locks in Exeter, a very famous pub down there. And one of the people that took part in my original study came up to me, ran over to me and said, Mark, I've just got to thank you so much from the bottom of my heart. He said, ever since I've taken part in your study, and this was actually a known problem gambler, I knew he was a problem gambler, he was attending Gamblers Anonymous meeting, took part in my research. He basically said, I gave every player the opportunity after they'd done my study to hear the playback of their recording if they wanted to. Now, out of the 30 people that were recorded, only 4 people actually wanted to hear the playback, and one of them was this guy. And basically, this was one of the what I'd call a real example where basically this gambler dissociated. Okay, he basically he talked away, he was having a conversation with the machine. When he heard this, he just could not believe that this was him, how he was on the machine. He was literally, to him, he was just somebody else. And he said every time after doing my experiment, he went to a fruit machine, all he could think about was this bloody tape that he'd heard back of him talking to the machine and actually treating the machine as if it was a real human being. And he said basically he got no enjoyment from playing the machine whatsoever. That. And one of the things, and I wrote this up as a case study, and I called it audio playback therapy as a kind of therapeutic treatment technique. Now, I'm not a practitioner. But I would love somebody that's practitioners go and actually have to test this experimentally. And the other thing I ought to say, actually, which I didn't mention, I mean, one of the interesting things that came from the people who I considered very hardcore players is that they went, getting them to think aloud was actually very hard. I think when something becomes almost an automated behaviour, they go on what I described as automatic pilot when they're playing the machine, they actually found it very hard to verbalise their thoughts. Now, this particular one, you know, the thing is, whenever they stopped, I would keep prompting them, you know, can you try and think aloud? But it was quite obvious. It's a bit like if you're asked to think aloud while you're learning to drive. When you're learning to do something, it's actually much easier than when you've actually learnt it, because, you know, you could be driving along and, you know, you can go an hour and not realise you've done all these things. You've just done them automatically. And that seemed to be happening on the machines as well. And then the final thing I'd say in terms of evaluation of this study, what are some of the good and bad things about it? Well, for the first time, I'd like to argue that I used both quantitative and qualitative dependent variables. That really hadn't been done in this situation before. Obviously, you could question whether the thinking aloud method is a good method to actually access cognitive thoughts. And even now, I mean, I do have problems with it, particularly, as I say, for those where the behaviour has become what I would call automated. We've got the reliability of the content analysis I did. I said the inter-rater reliabilities were fairly low, and I think I can explain those away, but it's quite clear that nobody's ever got anywhere near the kind of coding that I did myself. We have a biased sample in terms of the regular gamblers, 29 males, only 1 female. However, I would argue that's just very representative of the typical fruit machine player in this country. I would also argue that for the first time, as far as I know, it's the first time anything had ever been done in a real amusement arcade setting, so I thought the ecological validity was very high. And then we've got the question of whether it's actually generalizable to other forms of gambling. And in fact, there's been other people now that have done this type of methodology on things like virtual roulette and other things, and they've actually found exactly the same thing. So I actually do think there is some applicability to this. And I will leave it there. Thank you very much. And I think we're going to take a few questions now if people want to do that. So thank you.